Photographs capture far more than a moment in time. They tell a story. They have a life that lives on long after the moment of their taking. While the ability of great photographs to induce powerful emotions has been well described, what is less well known is how the photograph has influenced the life of the person who took it. I'm Anthony Feinstein. For the past 15 years, I've been investigating the psychological effects of war on frontline print journalists and photojournalists. Much of that work inspired the Globe and Mail's Conflict Photographer series, a year-long project that focuses on 12 photographers who are responsible for some of the most iconic images since the Second World War. During our frank and intimate conversations, the photographers spoke about the allure of what they do.
I really went through this process of falling in love with photography.
And also the price they paid in capturing their images. Prices that included not only post-traumatic stress disorder, but also grievous physical injury, emotional exhaustion, and at times searing guilt.
What you do, you lose all sense of purpose, of the decency of humanity, because you're trying to survive. Hmm?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, I wish that I could go back. I wish that I could make decisions that didn't lead to Billy dying. Yes. But I know it's impossible.
These are highlights from their reflections on their work, their lives, and how they found meaning through the lens of a camera.
I'm escaping. I'm an escapee from Devil's Island. Devil's Island was Finsbury Park. I'm an escapee. I don't want to be captured and taken back there. But I'm frightened of that place I started.
Don McCullen has been called the Goya of war photography. From Cyprus to Vietnam to the Congo in the Middle East, his work has cemented him as one of history's greatest war photographers. His career was launched by an overwhelming drive to escape the poverty of his youth.
When I was a kid, I was evacuated twice to the north of England to a really harsh chicken farmer and they used to lock us out until 10 o'clock at night in the cold, and he wouldn't let us in until 10 o'clock at night.
This was during the war?
Yes, during the war, 1942 or 43. And, I knew about poverty, I knew about cruelty, I knew about pain. It gave me a very strange personality. That hardship, in a way, made me the right man for this job.
Mm-hmm. That job, as you'll hear, has put Don McCullen on the front line of conflict for more than 50 years. When we met in New York last year, he had just returned from a trip to the Kurdish region of Iraq. Remarkable for a man in his 80s, who survived a recent stroke as well as quadruple bypass surgery. It was the story of the Kurds that drove Ashley Gilbertson toward a war that would become his obsession.
Because I felt so strongly that the Kurds had been betrayed twice by the Americans, and that should that happen a third time, I needed to document it.
Gilbertson was a young freelancer from Australia.
24, I guess.
When war in Iraq reignited in 2003 with a coalition of forces, including many Americans, led by then President George W. Bush. The Kurds had been brutally suppressed under Saddam Hussein. Many blamed Bush's father for betraying them when the Americans pulled out of Iraq in the Gulf War in 1991, Gilbertson among them.
In 2003, I went back to photograph the Kurds in the case that they were betrayed by the Americans again. Right. I didn't know what I could do. And I thought, like, what can I add? I don't know.
Pictures, it turns out. Soon he was working exclusively for the New York Times.
So, I mean, it was obviously very dangerous. I mean, did you enjoy the work?
Yeah. Very much so. I loved the work. I still do. I miss it. I mean, there's such a great sense of purpose of going out and photographing the news and witnessing these things firsthand. Iraq became my story and my thing. It's all I would think about. It's all, like, I would live, sleep, breathe Iraq. And I didn't care.
Yes.
The foreign editors always take your call. They always hear you out. Mm-hmm. And even if you've had a bad day, like, you're the Iraq correspondent.
Right.
Like, so you're the most important person in their universe at that moment. And then seeing the photographs appear in print and realizing that politicians, that military brass, that civilians, that policymakers all read this paper. And in some way, maybe it's a little way, you're showing them what's happening. And maybe, you know, having some influence in humanizing, you know, to show them that these are young men and women, Iraqi and American, who are dying over there as a result of decisions that we're making in Washington.
I really went through this process of falling in love with photography.
Corinne Dufka's obsession with photography emerged during El Salvador's civil war in the 1980s. When that wound down, another war was calling, Bosnia.
I have looked a lot at my motivation for being a war photographer for the, you know, for 12, 13 years that I did it, an incredibly intense period in which I covered, I think I counted it once, 17 conflicts on three different continents, and put myself at tremendous risk of being killed, and indeed have been wounded a couple times, one seriously. And I think in so many ways, motivation is so multi-tiered. The excitement of wanting to have a front row in history, I think to a certain extent with many photographers, when you put yourself in a position where you could die and you lose the precious thing that is life, there's really often a self-esteem issue underneath it, which is that you don't value your life. But the other one, I think, is you know, the political commitment to, or the commitment of wanting to make a difference, especially the longer I was in it, when I could see how powerful those images were and how they really did wake people up and make a difference, at least in terms of raising awareness about suffering. And it's hard to know which one, you know, is more dominant at a particular time in one's life.
It's a grim fact that opportunities for war photographers open up when a colleague is killed or injured. Such was the case for Dufka in El Salvador in 1988.
When two photographers were gunned down by the Salvadoran military at a checkpoint shortly before the elections. Roberto Navas was the one who was killed, and then Luis Galdames lost his arm from a gunshot. So I was then asked to fill in for Reuters.
You know, in order for me to have a good day, somebody's had a pretty shitty day. You know, so...
João Silva has been at the sharp end of conflict since the start of his career in his native South Africa in the early 1990s.
It's real lives that we're dealing with. It's real people in these photographs. Usually somebody's paid some sort of price in order for you to be left with that document that you've framed aesthetically or whichever way you've done, you know, because that's your professionalism, that's what you do.
Right.
Even in horrific situations, you're trying to compose the situation to make it, not appealing is not the right word, but to make it visually striking that people will look at it.
Right.
In spite of the terror, the horror that's within that frame.
Right.
And that's just the professionalism, because that's what we do, we make pictures, and we try to make good pictures.
Photographing war often comes at a huge cost in the lives of those who do it. The risks are enormous. Death and injury are a constant threat, as is making enemies of extremely powerful people. Ron Haviv captured the execution of civilians in Bosnia. For that, he was added to a wanted list of a Serbian paramilitary leader who told a Swedish journalist he looked forward to the day he could drink Haviv's blood. The process of capturing an image can be as varied as the situations that present themselves. Some are taken instinctively, some require planning. Ashley Gilbertson.
In November of 2004, I was with the Marines during the second offensive to retake the city of Fallujah, which had been overrun by insurgents since April. Like, we were on the very, very tip of the spear, so the most dangerous place to be. As a photographer, you have to be. Like, war moves so quickly. You've got seconds to get things. And if you're, you know, with a second unit or something like that, you're not going to see it. You'll see blood on the street and there's nothing to photograph. Mm-hmm. So with this group of 160 men, 12 people were killed, and I think it was another 40 were wounded in this week of combat. It was towards the end of the week that they'd fought their way through the whole city. And they had reached the southern edge of Fallujah.
Gilbertson is photographing a young soldier.
This guy called Alex Saxby.
In what's called a firm base.
Which was a house they had occupied.
The soldier shows him a photo he took of a dead man surrounded by rubble. The dead man was a sniper who had been shooting at American Marines from a minaret. Under the Geneva Conventions, mosques usually cannot be attacked. But if they are used by the enemy to provide cover for a sniper, all bets are off.
According to the Geneva Conventions, they were no longer holy sanctuaries.
Yes.
So I needed a picture to show that. I had a lot of pictures of Marines attacking mosques. I didn't actually have any photographs that provided evidence of, you know, insurgents using the mosques.
Right.
So I told the captain, I'm going to go photograph this dead insurgent in the minaret. It's 200 meters up the street. I'll be right back. Just tell everyone not to shoot me.
Mm-hmm. The captain refused and ordered an escort squad.
As soon as we got on the street, I felt like I shouldn't have done this. And people are like bristling with guns, and you know, every ounce of adrenaline you have all of a sudden pumps back into your vein. We get to the mosque, they start kicking the doors and clearing it. So I run over to the bottom of the minaret to go upstairs. William Miller and another Marine called Christian Dominguez wanted to go first. And I was like, no, I'll just go upstairs, get my picture, and we'll be out of here. I wanted it to be like over as fast as possible.
Once more, he was overruled by his military commanders. They entered the minaret.
And we climbed up, and it's dark. It's completely pitch black. And you can just hear the rubble. And there was rubble inside the minaret because a tank had actually shot the minaret. There's a slit, a small window in the side.
Right.
And a tank had shot that and put a hole in the side of the minaret.
As they ascended, he saw sunlight coming through a hole left by a tank shell.
So rubble had all fallen down. And that's what had killed this insurgent that was in there.
Right.
So I thought, like, great, this will be over soon. We'll get out of here. But then there were gunshots, and I got covered in water. I was covered, like my face and my body and my camera, like everything was completely covered in water. So I thought what must have happened was like somebody discharged their rifle and like shot the camel, they wear these camelbacks, yeah. It's like how you carry water. But then Dominguez started screaming to run. And we tumbled down the stairs. Like, I mean, it must have looked like a cartoon, it was insane. Like these three bodies just... Mm-hmm. Tangled up, falling down the stairs. And we fell at the bottom of the minaret. And I realized that it wasn't water. It was blood and white matter. And Billy had been shot point blank by an insurgent who I guess had backfilled the position.
Gilbertson sat on the ground, rocking back and forth.
And we're thinking that my life was over, and we're thinking that I had dishonored my profession, like photojournalist. I dishonored the newspaper, and I dishonored myself. I didn't know how to move. Like, I didn't know how to continue. I didn't know how to get up.
You felt that in the immediate aftermath?
Yeah. Yeah, I felt like the world, like my world had stopped turning at that moment, and I didn't know how to move. There was a fight to go back up the minaret and get Billy out. Another guy was wounded in that fight. And I remember sitting and watching that happening and just being absolutely horrified, thinking that more people were going to die as a result of this decision that I had made. And I know, like, we spoke about this, I've spoken about this with Jack, my therapist in New York. I know rationally I didn't pull the trigger. I know that I didn't kill him. But I still believe that it's my fault that he died. I made a decision. I agreed to go with the squad. Sure, this guy, like the insurgent who was in the minaret, might have killed a Marine on a different day, and I would have had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. But that day, I made a decision, and somebody died as a result.
More gunfire ensues as the squad retrieves Billy's body and retreats under machine gun fire.
They ran single file down the street. Under those like raking machine gun fire.
As he runs, Gilbertson recalls wishing he had been shot.
Because that would absolve me of all this responsibility and I could just die.
Ooh. Nearly 40 years separate the wars in Iraq and Vietnam. But for the conflict photographer, the process remains very much the same. Don McCullen's iconic image of a shell-shocked Marine stands as one of the most memorable and enduring images of the Vietnam War.
Tell me about that photograph you took of the Marine staring off into the distance in Vietnam.
Well, I was in the city of Hue, the imperial city, a kind of 12th century Mandarin-looking kind of city, and this great battle erupted during the Tet Offensive of 1968. And I was meant to go to a place called Khe Sanh, and when I got there, I saw a very distinguished photographer coming out of it, and I thought, oh, I can't go in if he's done it. And the man said, oh, don't worry, we're going to take out Hue. He said the North Vietnamese are really dug in there. It's going to be amazing. So I said, okay, I'll go to the Hue battle. Right. And it went on for 12 days. And I dug in with these Marines with hardly any equipment, no helmet and flak jacket and stuff like that. One day, about 2 or 3 days into the battle, the Americans were shelling from the South China Seas, 17 kilometres away, and they were dropping naval shells just in grid patterns in front of us. Mm. There were phantoms dropping napalm, which used to go over us and hit just in front of us, and then there was North Vietnamese mortaring, snipering. And then one day it all got so heavy, me and another man ran, and we jumped into a dugout in the wall, and I'm sitting there, and there was a terrible smell, but it was very soft. And I looked down, and I could see I was sitting on the fly buttons of a dead North Vietnamese soldier. I was sitting on his stomach. Hmm. And that's the ultimate place of madness. That is the ultimate dark place. And we both went to different places. Hmm. You lose all sense of purpose of the decency of humanity because you're trying to survive. Hmm.
And then you come across the soldier who's staring off into the distance. I mean, yes. Did you speak to him? Did you talk to him? Or did you just take his photograph?
I didn't. I said to a sergeant, what's the matter with that man? And he said, I don't know, and I don't care. Because you know why? He despised him. He thought he was trying to work his ticket away from the front. So I went up to the man. I just said hi like that. He didn't move. He was sitting there like that. I just dropped on my knees in front of him. I made 5 frames. There is impossible to tell the difference of those 5 frames. He never blinked an eyelid. He was hidden under the shadow of that helmet. Mm-hmm. And actually, we've come to hate it, actually, because it's become too symbolic. It's become too famous. It's become too iconic. Mm-hmm. It's become a piece of artwork. You know, people want to buy it.
Corinne Dufker's entry into the Bosnian conflict can only be described as harrowing. It was 1992. Central America's conflicts were winding down.
So I asked for a opportunity to go to Sarajevo.
After driving from Belgrade to Sarajevo,
I rented a small blue Opel. I was like incredibly nervous. This is a big opportunity for me.
She finds herself having to get across one of the several front lines that divided the warring factions.
I had to get across that airport, but it was under constant sniper fire. And in order to get into Sarajevo, you had to go over to the Serbian-controlled side of the airport, cross over that front line, and then eventually then to go through another front line to get into downtown Sarajevo.
I see.
So I befriended this, quite handsome Serbian tank driver. And I presented my dilemma to him in broken English and, the few words of Serbo-Croat that I knew then. And he said, I'll shield you across the airport. So I said, okay. I jumped into my Opel and he shielded me with this, huge tank.
So the tank went in front of you?
The tank went in front of me and protected me from, and all I could hear was zing, bing, zing. Zing, bing, zing, bing. Like, we were fired on the entire way across, the runways that you needed to go. And, had my little Opel pooped out, I would have been dead. But we made it across to the other side.
So he was your barrier? He was your shield?
He was my shield, yeah. And so he,
What did you feel in that moment as you were doing it and you were going across this airport and you could hear the bullets? What was your emotion at the time?
I don't know. Like, I was incredibly scared, but also really excited. Yes. And I think I was also motivated by the fact that I had to prove myself. Like, I had to prove that I was worthy of, the trust that Reuters had put in me, and that I could do this as a woman. Mm-hmm. And this was the bridge between my sort of lower level expectations of being a journalist and my expectations of really, making it as a professional war correspondent.
Within moments, wounded Bosnian soldiers were transported past Dufka, and she set to work photographing them. Film in hand, her next task was to get the film into Sarajevo to the local Bosnian paper.
Oslobođenja, it's sort of a famous newspaper, the most active newspaper in Sarajevo.
Another harrowing route lay ahead.
So I had an idea of where their office was. So I just got my little Opel again and once again set out completely on my own, and I just started racing on Sniper's Alley. Remember, these are snipers that some of them were Olympic quality snipers. And I didn't know really where I was going. And Oslo Mijenja was in the middle. I didn't quite know where, so I remember just zipping about a kilometer down that road and then getting off at an underpass and going down into the underground garage. I remembered, you know, the sense of relief when I went under that. And then I took my cameras and I went up and I introduced myself to the staff and I spent the night there.
Dafka's luck wouldn't last.
So this was in Vitez in January 1993. We had started covering the spin-off war between the Bosnian Muslims and Croats. So I went down with two colleagues, Hugh Payne and Kevin Sullivan. We were in Vitez, and then we decided to travel to Mostar because we'd heard that there was an emerging situation. So we went down and we're driving around. We checked in with the Brits, who maintained a peacekeeping presence around there, to get parameters. But the front line had changed the night before, unbeknownst to them. And I remember we were just driving around and looking at the scene of combat and destruction. There were fires burning all over the place. And it was me who said, I'm going to go take a closer look to be able to get a few pictures. And a little voice in my head said, don't go down that road. There's debris. And you should never drive down a road that has debris. And we talked about it, and I said, okay, we'll take a quick look. And as soon as, you know, shortly after we turned in, we ran over an anti-tank landmine. And I'll never forget just this ball of bright orange and red fire that just exploded and filled the entirety of the windshield. And then, you know, the three of us sort of spilled out of this car. And my first instinct was to get away from the car. And I walked away and I was bleeding. There was just blood everywhere. And I knew I was bleeding, but I couldn't figure out where. None of us were really that conscious of the other two. And I started walking down the road. And I remember just like, I don't feel any pain, but I couldn't figure out where I was bleeding. And blood was just everywhere. And then I touched my face and I realized my face had been cut. And it was cut by the camera lens. You know, the, at that point, the lenses were made of metal. And with the explosion, it had completely cut all the way through to my teeth. And then I walked, you know, about 100 meters. And then I also had damaged ligaments in both knees and both ankles, and then collapsed. At which point, my colleague Hugh came and picked me up. And then the Croats, they started sniping at us. Clearly, they could have very easily popped me off. But they chose not to, thankfully. But, you know, the Bosnian fighters came darting out of this labyrinth of houses in which they had their makeshift hospital and command headquarters. So they came out and they picked us up, threw me over their shoulder, and we were able to dart. And, you know, the whole time being fired at as we darted in.
So they took you to a hospital. They, they sutured your face. Did they?
Yeah, they sutured my face, and that was they took me to the British headquarters, and then we went in, we were evacuated to a makeshift military hospital, and then I remember asking this nurse, saying, what does it look like? And she said, I don't think you want to, you know, I don't think that you want to look in a mirror right now.
Did you have any, like, psychological repercussions from that? Was, did it, did that make you rethink, why am I doing this? Were you troubled by what had happened to you?
You know, weirdly, it worked just the opposite way. Instead of creating pause about the potential dangers, I felt emboldened by the fact that I had survived not only numerous combat situations, but I'd survived a situation in which I was seriously wounded. It served to create a sense of immunity.
So rather than look at it as a traumatic experience, you saw it as a survival experience, and you viewed yourself as lucky, as fortunate.
Yeah, as fortunate, but more than that, I viewed myself as is even more immune to harm.
For João Silva, the cost of being a conflict photographer have been enormous.
One below the knee and one above the knee.
His memories of the day he lost his legs are very clear. He was in Afghanistan, embedded with a U.S. infantry division. As a soldier cleared a doorway of a mud house ruin, he remembers being leery. The Taliban favored doorways for planting explosive devices. But the soldier appeared to clear the area, and so Silva followed. He took the first step, and he heard a metallic ping as though a spring had just popped. He had stepped on a landmine. In addition to losing his legs, his abdominal wall had been destroyed and needed to be rebuilt. He has endured over 60 surgeries.
I stopped counting at 47. And that was sometime in 2011.
Silva is only too aware that inches separated his footprint from those of the soldiers who preceded him. But he still has faith in the importance of his job. Yes, he regrets losing his legs, but he does not regret being there. His unwavering conviction has been one of a number of protective factors in his recovery.
So you got this fantastic medical care. Did they offer you any psychological care?
Yes.
Did he accept it?
No.
Why?
No, but I'll end up talking to tons of psychology students at Walter Reed.
They wanted to come learn from you.
Yeah, they kept dragging me in.
But why did you turn down
the psychiatrist at Walter Reed? He got pretty fascinated with me.
Right.
And we used to have long discussions, you know, but...
But why did you turn down the offer of therapy?
Because I didn't feel I needed it.
Okay.
But I was happy to talk, and when I spoke to all these students, I'd speak openly.
Yeah.
It's a voyage. You know, you start with the initial survival. There's that euphoria, okay, I'm alive, this is great. And then you got the big struggle, the medical struggle. You did, okay, that surgery's coming up now. And you just think about the next surgery. You don't even think about the consequences. You just think, okay, what, next week I've got this thing. If it works, fine. If it doesn't work, I'm going to have a shit bag on my side for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you take it. And so you, once you come out of that, next stage is, you know, you start learning to walk. You start doing all these things. Mm-hmm. And again, it's all very positive stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so it takes your mind away from... So
you're process orientated, you're goal orientated, where your energies go.
No, but that's normal for all of us, I think. I think for all of us it's normal. I mean, unless you just dive into a pit and don't want to come out of it, you know. And I had many nights where I was in a deep pit. You know, it's always worse when you're alone in the dark.
Yes.
And you just got fucking blinking lights from different machines staring back at you, ping, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm also only just fucking human. But, you know, you've got to fight fucking through the process. So, you know. So that was the first, that was the second stage. Then the third stage is like when you kind of come back into the world and you see the possibilities of the things that you can do, because at one point you thought you could do nothing. And then once you re-immerse yourself fully into what was a normal life once upon a time, you start slowly dawning on you how different life actually truly is now. How much things have changed in every way, because the euphoric process has ended now. You know, back to reality.
Right.
And that, to me, is where the difficulty lies, for me at least, you know.
So it's adjusting to a new reality.
It's adjusting to a new reality, to trying to figure out your place in the world, to accepting not being the Superman you thought you were once.
Right. Do you think in this very difficult journey that you've had thus far, do you think you developed PTSD or not?
I think I've always had it.
Yeah?
I think it's been there from, I mean, it's evident. I mean, I've just found my own way to deal with this shit, but... You are fucking traumatized, of course you are.
I understand you're traumatized.
You know, and that stays with I don't get the nightmares, I don't get that. You
okay.
know, you see, the post-traumatic stress disorder can manifest itself in many different forms, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just what the stereotypical, my God, you know, he's going to shoot himself or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. No, I don't have that. I've never had the nightmares,
right.
Never. I've never, ever experienced any of that shit, you know.
And the flashbacks and all the rest?
No, I don't get flashbacks.
Uh-huh.
The flashbacks that I get are self-induced because I'm now thinking about it. You know,
right.
I bring up the memory.
But when you bring up the memory, can you deal with that memory? Does
it doesn't
discombobulate you.
No, no, it doesn't. But it does. It will, you know, depending on what you're thinking of, it can change your mood. But that's just normal. You
mm-hmm.
know, you know.
And how long would that mood change last for?
Depends. I mean, you can go. It depends. It varies.
For Ashley Gilbertson, the trauma of that day in the minaret would be a turning point. He was racked with guilt and regret.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, I wish that I could go back. I wish that I could make decisions that didn't lead to Billy dying.
Yes.
But I know it's impossible. 2005, I didn't go back because I was, as you know, kind of a mess. I was suffering from post-traumatic stress.
Mm.
And... I couldn't face it. I remember not... I barely traveled, actually, in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't face the idea of getting on a plane. Like, I would look at an airport or a plane, and it just made me think it was going to take me back to Iraq, and something else would happen, you know.
It would take several years more of going back in and out of Iraq But eventually...
I made a conscious decision to try to stop doing it.
Mm. Why?
Because the more deeply I looked inside myself as to what I was doing, not why I was doing it at that point, but what I was doing, the more I had to acknowledge that the effect it was having, not just on me, but on my family and on my friends. I consciously ignored what me being in conflict did to my family, or did to my girlfriend and then wife, or my friends. Like, I wouldn't ask them about it. And I remember my bachelor party in 2006. I was drinking with all of my friends, and my little brother was there. And he opened up and started telling me about, like, what the effect it had on my family. And it was heartbreaking. Like, just seeing how it had manifested, like, this fear of losing me.
So your family being your brother, your parents?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
My aunt. And seeing, like, how real the possibility of losing me was, and, like, how I ignored that. And, like, all of a sudden, I couldn't ignore it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it really, really hard to even consider getting on a plane and going to a place where the chances of dying were remarkably high. The other thing that happened was I had a son almost 6 years ago. So that was in 2009.
Yes.
He asks about the war and what I was doing and stuff like that. And the idea of sitting in front of him and saying, I've got to go, I've got to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, if there's no I've got to go, like, I'm volunteering to go to this place where there's a remarkably high chance that I'll come home missing limbs or dead.
Mm.
And just the prospect of having that conversation, I mean, it's not a conversation I'm going to have.
There's only one war that changed my whole persona of myself and war and you know, the public out there. It was the Biafran War.
And why that one?
Because it involved the starvation of thousands of children. And you would go to a complex and see 800 of them dying.
One of those dying children, whose image Don McCullen captures...
The albino boy.
...has become an iconic image of that horrible conflict. The boy is holding an empty sardine can, his stick-thin limbs and torso magnifying the size of his head.
Possibly the greatest Lucifer that's still in my makeup. You know, I don't print him in the darkroom anymore. I can't take him.
And how did it change you? In what way?
Because I walked into a school one day where I found the albino boy, and there were children crawling around. I saw these children dying like flies in front of me. I saw children collapsing, having adrenaline shots with needles, and there was a French doctor there who looked in total despair.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, then the nasty storm of thought comes and says, you know, what the bloody hell am I doing here? What's this got to do with photography? I knew that when you went into those complexes, which were often schools, they would see the white man coming, and they would be given some hope that white man associated with, you know, aid, maybe we'll get something to eat. And what did they see? They see me coming in there with two Nikon cameras. How shameful that was.
So you felt guilt?
Yeah, well, if I didn't, when I looked into their eyes and photographed them, I wouldn't, you know, I knew I felt bloody uncomfortable. I felt like a charlatan. I felt like an assassin, you know. What help was I bringing them? You know, even the images I took of those children who would have died shortly afterwards, you know, going back to the West and trying to promote this propaganda would not save those kids I photographed. So, you know, and I had children of my own at the time. I had three children who would occasionally push their lunch away. I lived in Hampstead Garden suburb, you know, mm-hmm. at the time. So I'd come all the way back from that with all this stuff stuffed in my head.
And what did you do with that stuff in your head? How did you process it? Where did it go?
I tried to translate it in a way into my photography. I went into a complex. I have a picture of a woman who's sitting there, total despair, breast completely empty, flat, like plates, with a child gnawing on the nipple. But I could see some writing down the end on the wall, some graffiti. And while I was doing this picture, and I thought, I'm going to go down and read that writing. So I went down to read the writing, and it was extraordinary. It was the simplest of words, and it had on it, "Today I am reborn." It was a very kind of Christian, and I've never forgotten those few words. Mm. And I thought, reborn to what?
Mm.
You know.
So you come home to Hampstead Garden Suburb. You got your mind filled with these images and all this despair. When you got back, how did you feel emotionally? I mean,
I didn't know how I felt, really. I'd walk around, I'd go to dinner parties in the evening, despising the very people around that table who were offering me sustenance, you know. Mm-hmm. I would despise their conversation. I thought, why am I here? Why have I allowed myself to come here and sit and listen to this crap, you know? They were talking about the upside of life, and all I could see was these images. I can see them today. I have 60,000 negatives in my house. And they're deteriorating. Quite frankly, those negatives don't mean anything to me. And in fact, I almost feel like I want to destroy them. It's not the thought of a man slightly over the edge. I'm not over the edge. I'm very calm. I'm still in control, very much in control. But, you know, sooner or later, I get fed up with this world that's been very successful for me. I feel bad about it.
Hmm.
And why shouldn't I, really?
Where does one find solace after a life spent absorbing so much of the horrors of war? McCullen has been arrested and brutally beaten by Idi Amin's goons, gassed and shot with rubber bullets in Northern Ireland, wounded by a shell in Cambodia, fallen from a rooftop in El Salvador, assaulted on the streets of Beirut, and detained by Mad Mike Hoare's mercenaries in the Congo. Today, his greatest pleasure is photographing the landscape around his home in Somerset, England.
You can't take satisfaction in what you've done?
Only the landscapes. I've had a big passion for Hadrian's Wall that separates Northumberland from Scotland. I go up there and stand on that wall in the blizzards. And I know you could say, well, that's kind of flagellation in a way. It's masochism. It's got nothing to do with that. I stand there because I'm eating the passion that I generate within my soul. It's because I'm so in touch with myself. And this is not bullshit, I'm telling you this. I'm so in touch with myself. I'm so in touch with my work.
Do you think you've come to terms with your guilt? How do you manage your guilt then?
I've managed my guilt now because I know I'm looking at the edge of life at my age. I think, okay, how much longer can you go on whipping yourself? You know, so I'm saying, calm down. You know, accept what's happened. You know, I want to get rid of my archives. I wouldn't mind a bit of money now in my life so that I could have a much easier life instead of, you know, having to worry about can I buy another delivery of oil in the winter, you know. There are other people who want to do what I'm doing. They want to take away from me. They can have it. You know, it's a vacant lot there now. If somebody wants to take my kind of laurels away, they take the whole bloody lot, you know. What gives me more pleasure than anything in the world is to stand in the English countryside watching the changing sky.
For Ashley Gilbertson, moving on from the pull of war culminated in perhaps the most significant series of photographs he's ever produced. Bedrooms of the Fallen.
I mean, the Bedrooms is an apology to Billy at its heart.
Bedrooms of the Fallen is a heartbreaking book. 40 photographs of bedrooms frozen in time, memorials to lost youth. Each room is mute testimony to the grief of their custodians, the parents whose children were not be coming home from war. Sons and daughters may have departed as warriors, but there is little evidence of this in their bedrooms, the most intimate of chambers. Instead, we see the mementos of childhood and adolescence, lovingly preserved. Amid the sporting trophies, photographs, CD racks, toys, clothes and toiletries, the occasional teddy or favorite cuddly toy heightens the pathos, reminding us, lest we forget, of just how young these soldiers were.
The idea came from my wife. She at one point said to me, you have to photograph their bedrooms. 7 years later, it's the best idea I've ever had the opportunity to execute, hardest.
Did it help you with your grieving, with your sadness?
It gave me a place that... It's funny, it's... Yeah, I mean, it did. It gave me an opportunity to learn who these people were, which was really, and to learn where they came from,
mm-hmm.
and to see, to, you know, like there's one guy, Kirk Bosselman, who I was with in Fallujah, and he was shot and killed. I went and met his parents in Maryland. Turns out Kirk was like a theater buff. He would drive down to Washington and like see Shakespeare productions. You would never know that like a Marine yes. sniper, like badass, like here to watch your back and like kill anybody who's going to try to come close. All of that is like this theater buff. It was amazing. And so they would turn into these rounded human beings that I knew existed, but they would never tell you.
Right. Gilbertson became driven by a desire to understand who the fallen were and to convey this to a society more comfortable with brushing away the consequences of distant wars. The very nature of his project meant witnessing the loss of others and reflecting on it, not just photographing it. Immersing himself professionally in this way gave him that space to sit with his own painful memories and feelings.
Bedrooms of the Fallen is, as far as I'm concerned, the most successful project I've ever worked on.
Mm-hmm.
The saddest, the hardest, without a doubt. Like the book almost killed me. Mm. It was so, so difficult, except I'm so proud of it.
Mm.
Like it's a book about memorial, it's a book about memory, yes, but it's a book about war.
Mm-hmm.
Photographing the rooms, like I felt closer to war in those bedrooms than I did in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know like getting the blood on you and like being shot at and the adrenaline and the heartbreak and the trauma and all of that and the losses that we feel over there, it's real. But when that's happening, you're on a level, you're working on a level of survival. You know, you're not dealing with the emotional aspects of what's taking place in yes. front of you. You might break down for a short moment, but then like you're back into it and you're moving. Because if you break down, you'll die.
Yes.
Working in the bedrooms, there was nothing like that. It was the exact opposite. It was all about empathy. It was all about emotionally engaging with the family and feeling their losses. Yes. And then going into the rooms, it was like the world of foreign policy was like, it was crashing down on you. Like mm-hmm. this is what we did. This is what we asked for. By deciding mm-hmm. to go to war, this is what we created. These mm-hmm. awful, these rooms, these absent rooms.
After more than a decade of covering some of the world's most violent conflicts, Corin Dufker was growing wary with the work and with herself.
I kind of, along the way, became more obsessed with being the award winner and of getting lots of recognition. And I got sick of myself. I got sick of that part of it. And I realized that along the way, I just had lost a sense of humanity, where I, you know, was obsessed with not losing opportunities to the point where I wouldn't take vacations. I was obsessed with wanting to cover the types of projects, the type of situation that would lead to awards.
Right.
Dufker left the business in 1999 to work with Human Rights Watch, an NGO that does research and advocacy on human rights issues throughout the world.
So the work with the Human Rights Watch is perfect. I could still have, you know, doses of excitement,
mm-hmm.
and I could still do incredibly meaningful work. I won't say that it's more than journalism, because both human rights research and journalism, and photojournalism in my case, have incredibly important contributions to make to improving the human condition.
The business demands of photojournalism also wore on another journalist I profiled in this series. Alexandra Bular covered the Bosnian War, the fall of the Taliban, and the invasion of Baghdad in 2003. In a letter to a friend towards the end of her career, Bular writes, "I'm reaching a dead end with a medium that I love. I'm losing inspiration and faith because the magazines I'm working for do not allow me to express myself, but only use me because they know that I know what they want. I'm some kind of prostitute here, and I can't stand this position." Zhao Silva, on the other hand...
Do I have pride in what I do? Do I have pride in the role that I played
mm-hmm.
as a photojournalist in society? Absolutely, because I still believe that we play a valid role
Indeed.
And an important role.
Indeed.
You know, so I have to believe it, because otherwise, what did I lose my legs for?
So we need I'm not quite as cynical as some of the older guys get eventually. This means fuck all. No, yeah. I'm not like that. Mm-hmm. No, I truly believe that, you know, we don't change the world. But I've always maintained if I manage to change a single person's mind with one of my pictures, just a single person, mm-hmm. I've accomplished something. Mm-hmm. I've educated somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of enough for me, you know.
For the Globe and Mail, I'm Anthony Feinstein.